Please rise. The Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Ross, Judge Gaetis, Judge Halbrooks. The Honorable Judge Kevin G. Ross presiding.
Please be seated. And welcome to the Court of Appeals for this October 25 oral argument panel. We have three cases on our oral calendar this morning, all of which will be here in the courtroom, but I'll just note for the record that Judge Halbrooks is with us virtually. We're sorry that she can't be here in person, but we're glad that she's here. The first case on our calendar this morning is State of Minnesota, ex-relator Ken Elder versus U.S. Bank as the respondent. Counsel, each of you will have 15 minutes to present your argument with an additional 5 minutes to appellant's counsel if you'd like to use that time for rebuttal. Please state your name as you commence each leg of your argument, because we do keep track of the proceeding by audio recording as well as video. There is a button in front of the lectern there. You can elevate the platform to match your height for your convenience. Counsel, whenever you're ready to proceed, counsel for appellant, you have the floor.
Not sure where the button is.
In front in the panel there.
I think this height is okay. Thank you. I could spend 10 minutes trying to figure it out. So
it won't count against your time.
Thank you. Good morning. My name is David Golub, and I represent the appellant Ken Elder in this matter, which is an appeal from the dismissal of his False Claims Act action against defendant United States Bank, U.S. Bank. Mr. Elder's complaint alleges that U.S. Bank knowingly violated its statutory obligations under the Minnesota Unclaimed Property Act to report and report millions of dollars of cashier's checks that were abandoned pursuant to Section 34532C of that act. The complaint further alleges that U.S. Bank submitted false reports to conceal that violation in violation of their statutory obligation to attest to the authenticity and correctness of the reports. And the principal issues in this appeal involve whether Mr. Elder's complaint alleges the element of knowingly, that U.S. Bank acted knowingly and knowingly is defined by the False Claims Act to have a specific meaning. Knowingly means acting with actual knowledge, acting with deliberate ignorance, or acting with reckless disregard of the truth of information. The definition of knowingly under the Act specifically states that specific intent to defraud is not required to prove knowingly. And the issue of whether U.S. Bank acted knowingly as alleged in the complaint, whether the complaint is sufficient, arises in this case and in this appeal in a strange context. U.S. Bank admits that it knows the law. The complaint alleges that U.S. Bank maintains a department, an abandoned property department, which is trained in the laws of Minnesota, Ohio, and the other states, and trained to administer the laws, the abandoned property laws. U.S. Bank not only admits that, it submitted a declaration from its senior vice president in charge of that division with oversight responsibility, according to her declaration, for both Minnesota, Ohio, and the other states. It admits it knows the law, and 34532C is crystal clear. It says that if any check, any cashier's check purchased in Minnesota that remains uncashed 3 years from issuance, that check is cheated to the state of Minnesota, and the holder of that check has a duty to remit the money to the Commissioner of Commerce and to report that check to the Commissioner of Commerce. That law is crystal clear, and U.S. Bank admits it knows the law. And here's why this issue of knowingly is so strange. U.S. Bank admits it didn't comply with the law. U.S. Bank, in its brief to this court, in its brief below, says it didn't comply with the law, and it didn't comply with the law because U.S. Bank says Minnesota's law, according to U.S. Bank, is unconstitutional, it's preempted, and it, quote, is of no legal effect. According to U.S. Bank, in its brief to this court, 34532C, which is the principal escheatment law in Minnesota for written instruments held by a bank. According to U.S. Bank, that statute is a historical aberration. That's its words. That statute was based upon an archaic and outdated provision in the 1954 Uniform Act, Uniform Unclaimed Property Act, promulgated by the National Commissioners. And that statute, according to U.S. Bank, is preempted. It's preempted whenever U.S. Bank holds checks where it doesn't have the last known address.
Mr. Gillip, I'm wondering, given our standard of review, are we even supposed to consider what U.S. Bank alleges that its practice is? It alleges that its practice is to follow. But given that we have to assume the truth of the allegations in the complaint, I mean, do we even get there?
Well, I agree with that, and especially because the complaint doesn't say that they follow the federal common law. The complaint doesn't say that's what they do. The complaint says just the opposite. The complaint says they don't remit the checks to Minnesota even when they know the last known address. That's paragraph 32 of the complaint. The complaint says they falsely invoke Ohio law even though Ohio law doesn't escheat those checks. But the issue is they convinced the district court judge to dismiss this case on the grounds that the complaint didn't allege knowingly with sufficient particularity, and the fact that they're claiming preemption, the fact that they're claiming they know the law but it's preempted, preemption, it doesn't go to knowingly under the False Claims Act. Preemption is a defense. Federal preemption is a defense to liability. That's, by the way, what the federal court held when they tried to remove this case to federal court. It was remanded. They made the preemption argument there, and the federal court said that is a defense. This case is based upon Minnesota law, and the issue of federal preemption is a defense. They then came to the trial court, and they said the district court, and they said, well, you didn't plead knowingly. Well, the complaint says knowingly. The complaint, and it's not simply knowingly in the abstract. The complaint explains why it's knowing. The complaint talks about the abandoned property department at U.S. Bank. The complaint says that U.S. Bank knows the law because its executives and personnel are trained in each one of the states. The complaint says that they have all of the information to comply with 345.32C. The complaint says that they falsely invoke Ohio law, even though they know Ohio law doesn't apply. The complaint says that they falsely represent to Ohio that they don't have the addresses for all the people, even though they do. And these are paragraphs 31 and 32 of the complaint. The complaint says that they do this on a nationwide basis and that it's part of a scheme to take advantage of Ohio's favorable unclaimed property laws. Now, we have to prove that. But for the purposes of alleging knowingly, those allegations are not simple bare bones allegations of knowing. Those allegations are an allegation of knowingly supported by paragraph after paragraph after paragraph. And you are absolutely right, Judge, that you wouldn't get to that normally on a motion to dismiss, except that's their position. Their position is you should find, this is their position in their answering brief, it was their position below, it's their position in their answering brief, you should find that they didn't act knowingly because it's preempted. That is their argument as to why this complaint is not sufficient on the issue of knowingly. And I submit to you that is not a proper argument for attacking the sufficiency of an allegation of knowingly. It's an argument for attacking on the merits. If they had come in.
But if the basis for the factual determination of knowledge is the legal premise that Minnesota law, about Minnesota law, wouldn't this be a legal question then, and not necessarily one that needs to be resolved in a trial?
It could be a legal question, but then they would have to put in evidence, and they'd have to put in evidence in a couple of different respects. First of all, they'd have to put in evidence. They'd have to dispute the allegations of the complaint. They say, we followed the federal common law rule. we sent these checks to Ohio because we didn't have a last known address for them. The complaint says they lied to Ohio. The complaint says, this is paragraph 32, they did have a last known address and they sent checks to Ohio anyway. So one thing they would have to do to make this preemption argument is dispute that, which of course they couldn't do on a motion to dismiss. But even if they wanted, even if, let's say that paragraph wasn't in the complaint, what they would have to do to make the preemption argument is they would have to come in and say, all of the checks, assuming preemption, and I don't agree with preemption, but all of the checks that are at issue, we didn't have a last known address for them. Therefore, we followed the federal common law rule. They would have to lay that, because that's not in the complaint, they would have to lay a foundation.
And in other words, you're saying it's still a fact issue, even if preemption were...
Yes, and that's why it's a federal defense. It's a defense. Federal is a defense. And the problem that they have, and this is, they're not just attacking 345.32c. This argument that they've made that the statute is based upon the 1954 Uniform Act and it's archaic because it was before Texas versus New Jersey was decided in 1965, that argument is wrong. The 1981 Uniform Act promulgated by the National Conference of Commissioners of Uniform State Laws, the 1995 Act, the 2016 Act, every act subsequent to Texas versus New Jersey contains the provision that is similar to the provision here. Every one of those acts contains the provision that says, if you don't know the last known address of the owner of any intangible property, not just Cheshire Chest, but any intangible property, if you don't know the last known address, the state of place of purchase may escheat the property.
One of the big arguments that respondent is making, in addition to the one that we've discussed, concerns your failure to plead with particularity, given that the claims involve allegations of fraud. And I think that it seems to me the standard is a little fuzzy, but I think we all know that that means you have to articulate the who, what, where, and when. How does your complaint satisfy that requirement exactly, specifically?
I will do that. I'll answer that, but let me give an introduction. And that is, this argument was raised by U.S. Bank in California in a complaint in California, which they characterized as, quote, nearly identical. Same allegations, because the conduct was similar in California. They raised it in the trial court in California, they lost it, and they took an appeal to the California Court of Appeals, and the California Court of Appeals said they upheld the sufficiency of the complaint on these same allegations, and they don't mention that in their complaint, in their brief. They don't mention the fact that they've litigated this case to an appellate court in California and lost it.
You're not saying that decision in California would be binding on this court.
I don't, but it certainly is worth looking at. You have an obligation, I think, to tell the court that you've lost this issue in another case.
Haven't you lost this issue in another case, too?
I did, and we told the court that, and we explained that the court in Illinois didn't consider the California decision, and the Cal Court in Illinois didn't consider the Illinois federal court decision, which also upheld what they call in their complaint, in their brief below, a similar complaint under Rule 9b. But let me now answer your specific question. The fraud in this case involves the reports. The reports are each identified. They're identified in paragraphs 36 to 46. The reports...
And you're referring to the investigative reports?
No, I'm talking about the abandoned... The reports are the abandoned property reports. That is what was fraudulent here, the abandoned property reports. Those are paragraphs 36 to 46. The information that was fraudulent about the reports is identified. They didn't include checks that were required to be escheated pursuant to 345.32c. Paragraph 27 of the complaint gives examples of those checks. Those checks are not in Mr. Elder's possession, and federal law, federal 9b law, is very clear, and we cite these cases in our brief, that where the defendant has proprietary information in its possession, the standards of Rule 9b, which are similar to 902, obviously, are relaxed, and the relator doesn't. These are False Claims Act cases. Chorchis is a False Claims Act case from the Second Circuit. The standards are relaxed, and you don't have to identify, and you can. And the standards are also that you can give examples, and we give examples of checks that are subject that we believe are subject to that were subject to escheatment to Minnesota. So the reports are identified, checks are identified, the information that's omitted is identified, the date of the reports is identified, to whom the reports were submitted is identified, to the Commissioner of Commerce in Minnesota.
Well, let me just ask you about these reports. I mean, these are just reports that the bank is required to submit to the state, right?
Yes.
And I guess I just push back a little bit on the idea that the fact that they submit these reports is in itself evidence of, a knowing falsehood. How are these reports, which are just commonly supplied to the state as a matter of course of business, knowingly false?
No, that's a fair question, but there's an answer. So 34541 requires the holder to not just submit a report, but to identify every cashier's check in its possession that is subject to escheatment, and to verify that. It has to be a verified report that lists all of the cashier's. It's not limited, by the way, to cashier's checks. It's limited to any property subject to escheatment that year. These are yearly reports. And the purpose of the report is to enable the commissioner to verify that the holder has in fact complied with its obligations, because the reports you can then compare to the actual remittances that are made. That's what these reports are designed to do. By the way, this is what the complaint alleges as well. So the falsity is they knew that there were these checks. They knew that there were these checks that they weren't reporting. They knew that they were checks that were subject to 34532C, and they intentionally did not include them, and they're admitting that. They're saying, well, we had a defense to it, but this is, I mean, for them to be saying, well, there's an issue about knowledge here, that's not the issue in this case. The issue in this case is, is there a preemption? Did they have to comply? Remember, the Act does not require a specific intent to defraud.
If you've fully answered the specific question, your time has expired.
I'm sorry.
That's all right. You will have 5 minutes of rebuttal, but before you leave the podium, I'm going to make sure that Judge Hallbrooks, if she has an opportunity to ask a question. I'm not sure if she has one. This is unusual that we have one of our judges by Zoom.
Thank you.
Yeah, thank you, Judge Ross. No, the questions that I actually had, you have posed, and Judge Gaetis has as well. Thank you.
Thank you. Judge Gaetis, do you have any further questions?
I may think of a better answer while I'm sitting down, but thank you very much.
You'll have opportunity to think and listen at the same time.
Right, okay.
Counsel for respondent. Okay, found the best.
This is always an issue I have with the podiums. Good morning, Your Honors. This is Casey Curtis on behalf of respondent U.S. Bank. So I guess at the outset, I just want to make something very clear, which is the property issue. You know, U.S. Bank doesn't have a dog in the proverbial fight about whether it goes to Minnesota or Ohio. This is unclaimed property. It doesn't belong to U.S. Bank. U.S. Bank just wants to report it to the right state.
Well, if it doesn't have a claim in it, was the district court correct in determining whether there's an indispensable party that wasn't included in the complaint?
Well, I think that is a significant problem here, in that because a number of the checks have been remitted to Ohio, Ohio is an indispensable party. I think that's an additional problem. The district court obviously declined to raise that issue. I do think that would be a problem should the lawsuit go forward. Obviously, that could potentially present an independent grounds for affirmance as well, given that the Minnesota courts are not able to bring Ohio in as a party to the lawsuit. So that would potentially be another way to come at the same issue. But unfortunately, this is a circumstance where we have multiple facets to kind of the same problem. Just to clear up a couple of things, because I think that this is important. Elders Council had repeatedly kind of describes this as a circumstance where we're having, a fight over whether there's scienter, and they treats this as a factual representation. But the issue in this context is because of the nature of the reporting requirements under Ohio law, under Minnesota law, there's an inherent legal premise underlying it. In Minnesota, for instance, the banks are required to self-identify and self-report checks that are subject to statement under the statutes. The same thing is true in Ohio. As a result, although Elder wants to frame this as a factual issue to try to get past a motion to dismiss, the reality is that there's a legal issue underlying this, which is what is the correct place to escheat the checks. That's what the district court obviously focused on in its decision, focused on the lack of legal certainty as, in terms of the answer to that question, and said in light of that lack of legal certainty, the requisite scienter under the statute can't be alleged. Just very briefly to respond to appellant's discussion of the California case, because I think that this is important, just to be clear, that case does not address the pleading standard and whether effectively the fraud was pled with specificity. California doesn't have, it has different code of civil procedure, doesn't mirror the federal rules, doesn't have an equivalent to, it has, fraud is required to be pled with specificity, but it doesn't have like a Rule 9 type standard in that exact way. And moreover, in the California case, that was actually interlocutory review from an order overruling a demur. So it wasn't a circumstance where the whole case was before the court. Rather, the court took up specific issues and decided three questions, which had to do whether there was a controller notice, which is a unique procedure under California law, whether the obligation was sufficiently established as a matter of California law to present a False Claims Act claim, and then a necessary party issue in the context of a due process thing under the Western Union case, which it really just said it's not going to resolve at this stage. So none of that addresses what appellant was arguing in terms of the idea that that court had found that the claims are sufficiently pled or sufficiently pled under Rule 9. Turning then to kind of the substance of the case and the meat of the issue, which is what do we do with Minnesota statute? Because on its face, Minnesota statute is inconsistent with the rules set forth by the Supreme Court in the Texas versus New Jersey case. On its face, Minnesota statute lays claims to all checks issued, all unclaimed cashier's checks issued in Minnesota. That would, by definition, include unclaimed cashier's checks where there is a last known address, and the last known address is somewhere outside of Minnesota, so long as the check is issued in Minnesota. U.S. Bank is obligated under the laws of the various other states in which it does business and the Texas versus Jersey case to escheat those checks, even though Minnesota statute on its face lays claim to them, to those other states. So we're left with a circumstance where we have a statute that is on its face inconsistent with the rules set forth by the Supreme Court to which U.S. Bank is required to comply. The argument that appellant has made in terms of why there is not preemption or that preemption is in defense, aside from trying to transform what is a legal question into a factual question to get past a motion to dismiss, is effectively that Ohio doesn't lay claim to these funds, that he has an interpretation of Ohio law under which Ohio isn't requesting the funds because he believes there's a presumption about where the last known address would be, and therefore, U.S. Bank isn't obligated to sheet those to Ohio. The problem with that argument, and I think this is the most important aspect of our brief, really lies in 169.04b and its statement that Ohio is going to take custody of unclaimed address unknown property and hold it in effectively trust or hold it to the right of other states to make claims. So on the face of the Ohio statute, it says, if the holder doesn't have address, send it to Ohio. Ohio will hold it, and other states, in this instance Minnesota, would have a right to go to Ohio and request the funds. So to the extent Minnesota wants this money, under Ohio law, there's a mechanism for that to happen. It's also in the record, and Elder alleges this both in the complaint, that we are following Ohio law. His allegation of the fraudulent scheme is that we have fraudulently determined that Ohio is somehow beneficial to us, and therefore we're going to treat these checks as subject to Ohio law. That's repeatedly in the case, which, again, the legal premise underlying that is simply the application of the Texas versus New Jersey rules, right? But all of that gets back to Ohio has possession of these funds. That's consistent with what the Ohio statute says on its face in 169.04b. And if Minnesota wants the money and believes it has a superior claim, it has a right to go to Ohio and effectively request the funds. The problem with this case, and the reason why I think it was properly dismissed, is this is not a False Claims Act action. If there's a dispute here, as Elder sees it, it's a hypothetical dispute between Minnesota and Ohio as to basically who has a superior right to these funds. U.S. Bank doesn't have them. It has turned them over to Ohio because on its face, the Ohio statute says that when there's address unknown funds, we don't have it on the books and records of the holder don't have them. It should send them over to Ohio. Ohio will keep them and then subject to the rights of other states to make a claim.
But what they're alleging is that the Ohio laws are much more favorable to U.S. Bank, and U.S. Bank stands to gain by submitting the funds to Ohio, you know, following Ohio law. I mean, that's what their allegations are, and we're required to assume the truth of those allegations, right? So just sort of help me find the way to your position, given what, you know, the Rule 12 standard of review is and what the allegations in the complaint actually are.
Sure. So 2 points. So you're required to accept the truth of factual assertion, not legal assertions, right? Legal assertions and the idea that to the extent that he makes an averment that Ohio isn't making a claim to these funds, you know, or Ohio law doesn't make a claim to these funds, that is a purely legal question. That's something, not something we defer to. You have an independent obligation to look at the Ohio statutes and determine whether Ohio is laying claims to these funds. In terms of the contentions that he's made about why Ohio law is or it's less favorable, in the original, I think in the complaint as originally framed, he said, well, it could be that U.S. Bank, if it avails itself of Ohio law, has a right to retain 90% of the funds, without actually specifying whether that's happened, just said it was hypothetical. But in connection with a motion to dismiss, because complaint relies upon and incorporates by reference the reports that were submitted, we submitted copies of the reports that were admitted to Ohio. Those are in the record as, I think it's index number 45. They're properly considered in the context of a motion to dismiss under, I can give you the case name, but I think it's the Inri Hennigan County Recycling case from the Minnesota Supreme Court that says that when a complaint relies upon and necessarily incorporates by reference material, that's properly considered as part of a motion to dismiss. So here, given that the pleading necessarily relies upon the reports and says the reports are fraudulent, I think they are properly considered. And the reports show on the face that we have remitted the funds. The second argument that he's made is all of the funds, 100% of the funds. The second argument he's made is, well, there is a difference between the escheat periods that effectively.
And there's no allegation that that part of the reports are false.
I'd have to go back and look. I don't know off the top of my head, but I think that that is correct. Yeah, I mean, the reality is, I think, in this circumstance, because the incorporation by reference doctrine, they're part of the pleading, they're incorporated. He has not contested the validity of the reports when they were submitted. I think the district court properly relied on them in that circumstance, and it shows 100% of the funds. His second argument as to why there would be a benefit is that Ohio requires effectively the funds to be remitted at 5 years, and Minnesota has a 3-year escheat period. But that is really an illusory difference insofar as in both circumstances, if again, there's a legal issue underpinning this about Ohio says that we're supposed to give them to Ohio, that in that circumstance, in both instances, Ohio versus Minnesota are making competing claims to the funds, and we have to resolve the competing claim. The idea that it's beneficial for us to hold on to them because the escheat period between the two states is the same, I think, is really an artifice, given that in both circumstances, the state is making a claim, and we have to deal with the claims, and we're supposed to deal with them, and really not be stuck in the middle here, which unfortunately, in this circumstance, we are.
But if you can retain the funds for 5 years rather than 3 years, that is a benefit to U.S. Bank, isn't it, ultimately?
So I think that there is a question. I don't know the answer to that in terms of if we get the benefit of the interest in some states. The interest that accrues in the interim goes to the state, and I just don't remember whether that's the case in Ohio or not. But, you know, again, I still think the problem underlying it, even accepting that there is a difference in the state period, is if we have competing claims to the funds, we're supposed to follow the Supreme Court's rules. We're left in a circumstance where You know, we have a statute in Minnesota that on its face is inconsistent with what the Supreme Court says. We have a statute in Ohio that says, in the circumstances where we have unaddressed unknown funds, we're supposed to turn them over. Now, Elder's response to that is, well, there's a presumption in Ohio that says checks issued or purchased, I guess it's purchased, not issued, because Minnesota's issued and then Ohio, the other states, sometimes use the words purchased. But for all intents and purposes, let's ignore that difference. That checks, address unknown checks are presumed to be, the owner is presumed to be in the state of purchase. But that provision is freestanding from 169.04B, which says if the holder doesn't have an address, we're supposed to have it. If Elder was right about what the presumption means, 169.04B would be worded differently, and it's not. It would say if there's no address, or there's no presumed address, and that's not what it says. It merely speaks in terms of the holder and the funds. And again, in this record, and what we have before us is, you know, Elder wants to avoid the, kind of evade this conclusion, but Ohio is in possession of the funds. They've been submitted to Ohio. Ohio's taking custody of them. And this is, I think, a really important point that we just shouldn't lose sight of. These funds belong to someone. There is a owner or payee on the unclaimed cashier's checks who is rightfully entitled to the money. The job of unclaimed property law in the states is to effectively first try to reunite the property with its owner. Under Ohio law, by taking custody of these funds, the owner has a right to go to Ohio and to reclaim the funds. So the idea that this is somehow just a gratuitous undertaking that U.S. Bank has provided is really a fallacy when you look at what the statutes require, which is that if someone in Ohio, if an owner of these funds goes to Ohio by virtue of the fact that U.S. Bank has sent the money to Ohio, sent the reports to Ohio, Ohio now has a statutory obligation to give the money that we've sent to Ohio back to the owner. So that in, not only is, I think, his interpretation of Ohio law wrong, we have in the record that Ohio has the money, and under Ohio law, there's a legal significance that attaches to this. It's not just like there's a gratuitous undertaking of giving money, to Ohio. The other point that I would add, and admittedly, you don't have to go there if you conclude that there's a conflict between Ohio law and Minnesota law in relation to this point, is the Third Circuit's decisions, in particular, I think it's the Marathon Pipeline case, explain that even absence a direct conflict, the Texas versus New Jersey rules apply. And one of the reasons that they have reached that conclusion is they note that one of the purposes behind the Texas versus New Jersey rules is not just to resolve conflicts between states, but to protect the owner of the funds. And the idea that in the absence of a conflict, that some state can just make like claim to funds to which it really has no jurisdictional connection or no constitutional connection, presents problems for the owner of the funds, because now, in example of the Marathon case, Delaware is laying claims to funds even though there's no nexus between the owner of the funds and Delaware. And that, again, is the underlying purpose of the Texas versus New Jersey priority rules. And what we're really left with is a circumstance where, unfortunately, the law is muddled, and his allegations are not really that we made a factual misrepresentation, it's that we've misapplied the law, and we don't think that supports the scienter necessary to support a false claims act claim. With that, I see my time is out.
Can I pose a question to Mr. Curtis before?
Yes, certainly.
Thank you. Mr. Curtis, could you briefly respond to the statement made by Appellant's counsel this morning that it's difficult to plead with more particularity because of the proprietary circumstances that govern this information?
Sure. So,
is my question clear to you?
Yeah. No. I'm just trying to think of what the response is. I mean, the issue normally in a False Claims Act action is that a relator is a whistleblower with some type of inside information. That is not Mr. Elder. Mr. Elder is a professional relator who has a legal theory. And I think the concern, there could be a circumstance where a relator who's a whistleblower has inside information and can allege it. I think the difficulty that he's identified is he's an outsider, he has this theory, and he can't allege further facts. But I think that that is really a reason why there shouldn't be a False Claims Act action, not a reason to relax the pleading standard, is I guess my response.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Any other questions for me? Thank you. Counsel for appellant, any rebuttal?
Thank you. Let me respond first to Judge Holbrook's question.
And now do you know where the button is so you can lower that if you'd like to?
I'll leave it this way.
You're okay?
All
right.
Yeah, I'm okay. If you can see me, I'm
okay. We can see you.
All right. Let me respond first to Judge Holbrook's question. On page 25 of our brief, we cite the cases, all of which state the proposition that where it's proprietary information in a False Claims Act, the relator's burden is relaxed for 9B purposes. They want to make this an they've argued this is Mr. Elder's not an insider. You don't have to be an insider. Mr. Elder's companies assists individuals in reclaiming property from abandoned property around the country, and he noticed the anomaly in Ohio's filings and was able to develop the case. We then investigated it, talked to people, and determined what we've alleged. But the cases on 25 are specific on this point, that where it's proprietary information in the possession of the defendant, the burden is relaxed. And the argument that was just made to you about the purpose of the statute is really important. It is, the purpose of the statute is to protect the owners of the property. And if you buy a check in if you buy a check in Minnesota and you live in Minnesota, and they send that check to Ohio, you don't get notice. The Unclaimed Property Act in Minnesota requires the holder to give notice to the property owner, by publication or by registered mail of the fact that his property may be escheated. And because they're sending this to Ohio, Ohio doesn't give any notice to anybody in Minnesota. Nobody in Minnesota knows this, and that is the exact purpose. The purpose of protecting the owners is to give them notice. Now,
are you alleging that I know that there's been a difference in language used between the briefs regarding the nature of these checks? The respondent is referring to the address unknown checks, and you seem to be disputing that these are even address unknown checks that you're talking about.
Yes, we do, and that's paragraph 32.
And is your assertion that they're not address unknown checks based on the parties that the checks are made payable to, including the Minnesota government entities that you specified as examples?
Well, that's not necessarily the basis for it. What we've alleged, actually, and what we know is to be true, that's not disputed.
We can pause you for just 1 second. I think your mic went out.
I'm sorry.
Okay.
Can you hear me okay?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
People buy cashier's checks in the same way that people used to put money in mattresses 50 or 100 years ago. They buy them for security. They buy them for themselves. And the U.S. Bank sells these checks only to its customers. Its customers who buy the checks, David Golub buys a check, and the payee on the check is the person who purchased the check, David Golub. And they've got David Golub's account address, because I'm an account holder of U.S. Bank. They have that in their files. They know my address. They know that I've bought the check because their records say that. This is what's alleged in the complaint. And they nonetheless send those checks to Ohio. Those are address known checks. And they don't address that in their brief. They argue last address unknown. They don't address the fact that we dispute that they follow the common law in what they're sending to Ohio. That's a factual dispute in the complaint, and they don't address it. And that is why this motion to dismiss couldn't be granted on those facts.
That would, you acknowledge, be a factual dispute only on some of the checks.
Yes, exactly right. That would be a factual dispute on some of the checks. Now, the other issue that's important is the district court below evaluated Ohio law at page 5 and 6 of her decision and concluded that Ohio law does not provide for the escheatment of out-of-state checks where they're purchased out of state and not owned by an Ohio resident. And the district court carefully reviewed Ohio law in that respect. And the district court did that shortly after the California Court of Appeal rejected USB's argument, the identical argument it's making here, They rejected USB's argument that Ohio law provides for the escheatment of out-of-state checks that are not owned by Ohio residents. That argument was, Mr. Curtis just referred to the three arguments that were raised on appeal. That was their principal argument. The same argument here, that we had to do it, we had to send it to Ohio because Ohio law requires the escheatment of such checks when we don't have the last known address. And the California Court of Appeal agreed in the same way that the district court held that that wasn't the case. If I can just finish this answer, please.
If you can finish your thought,
thank
yes.
you very much. What the district court said was, even though there's no actual conflict, there's, quote, a perceived conflict. She said there's a perceived conflict because Ohio accepted the money. And that, with all due respect to the district court, is erroneous, because when Ohio got the money, Ohio didn't know where the checks were purchased. Ohio, the records that are submitted to Ohio simply say, David Golub, address unknown. It doesn't say to Ohio, which would have had to be escheatable under Ohio law, it would have had to have been a check purchased in Ohio if you don't know David Golub's address.
Thank you, Mr. Golub.
Thank you very much.
With your time expired, this closes our oral argument today. Thank you to both counsel for your oral arguments today and your thorough briefing on this matter. It is submitted now. We take it under advisement, and we will issue our opinion within the statutory period.
Thank you both.
Thank you.